Now, yesterday and day for yesterday, we had some very interesting discussions on the psychology of attachment, detachment, freedom, and so on, which are so crucial in Vedantic way of life. So, I shall begin with a brief discussion on the psychology of attachment and what I would prefer to call deep, not non-attachment, rather than detachment. Now, you find, broadly speaking, there are three categories of people among spiritual seekers. Those who are fully attached, obsessed with what they are doing, slavishly attached. They are not even aware of the fact that they are attached. Which means the very concept of non-attachment doesn't exist for them. Attachment itself is their world. We are not talking about them. We are talking about those who understand that there is such a thing as attachment, and there's a problem with that condition, and it is better to remain non-attached, but would like to know how to remain non-attached. And then the third category is the category of the highest spiritual seekers who never get attached. They're always free. They're working 24 hours of the day, doing their duties and responsibilities. But such a thing as attachment doesn't exist for them. In fact, for two categories of people, there is no attachment. One, those who are always attached, because they do not recognize attachment as attachment. It's a bliss. Is a blessing for them. Sri Ramakrishna talks about the fish, you know, which are already caught in the net, and they think it's a very wonderful situation, very happy. They think they will have a very wonderful time. They don't know that they're going to be killed and eaten. Now, for them, there is no such thing as attachment because they do not have the concept of non-attachment. See, after all, if you don't have the concept of light, you don't have the concept of darkness. One is the opposite or the absence of the other. Now, coming to the problem of attachment and the problem of how to become non-attached, that's the subject before us. So in Vedanta, there are four fundamental qualifications that every spiritual seeker should try to achieve, which is technically called sadhana chatushtaya. After a brief discussion of this, I will come to the subject. The first qualification is that we must have a correct understanding or a concept of what is real, what is the real. The real, the capital letter R. What is the real? It means what is the absolute reality. All of us have got our own understanding, concept of what is real. In fact, our concept of the real very often depends upon our own spiritual and cultural evolution. A person who considers money as the highest reality, he belongs to the category of those who want to enjoy this world, nothing more. So everyone has got one or other idea of the real, the ideal in their life. Now, as we understand spiritual values, our interpretation of the real changes, evolves. As we culturally and spiritually evolve, we will have a higher and higher understanding or concept of what is the absolute reality. For the most spiritually enlightened person, God is the only absolute reality. For Sri Ramakrishna, only God existed. There is nothing else for him. God is the only reality for him. Everything else is relatively real. Now, we often, when we discuss this point, the question arises, what is the status of this world, our homes, our relationship with friends and relatives, sisters and brothers and parents and children, professionals, colleagues and so on? And what is our relationship with our duty, with our office, with our status as maybe husband, mother, son, daughter, and so on. Vedanta says, this world and all these relationships are not absolutely real, but they are not absolutely unreal either. So sometimes we may call them real with a small letter R, in the sense they are real, they are relativity. They are only relatively real, not absolutely real. So on the one hand, the highest absolute reality, which in Vedanta is called the Paramarthika Satta, the absolute reality. And Vedanta says, Brahman or Atman, or if you are a devotee of God, God is the only absolute reality. Everything else may be real, but real only in a very, very relative sense. In the sense, it is real now, tomorrow it is unreal, it goes away. Everything in this world, including this earth, this cosmos, this universe, may exist maybe for a few millions of years, and then vanish. Vanishing doesn't mean total disappearance, but change. In Vedanta, there is no such thing as complete destruction. There is only change of name and form. So anything that undergoes change in terms of name and form is real only in the relative sense. It means they're all relativity. They belong to time, space and causation, which is technically called maya or mithya in Vedanta. And we are all in mithya. It doesn't mean that we are totally unreal. We can't say this book is unreal, you are unreal, the chairs are unreal, nobody says. It's a terrible misunderstanding. Often in philosophical conferences, people ask this question. Especially those who have not learned Vedanta from teachers, they would say, they read English translation, and English translation, the world is an illusion, is written. Now, if we go to psychology, what is illusion? We are optical illusion. There is no voice coming. You imagine there is a voice coming. You see a form, there is no real form, you call optical illusion. Similarly, this Lake Tahoe doesn't exist, the mountains don't exist, chairs don't exist. That's what Vedanta says. In that case, Vedanta is the most ridiculous thing that you could have in this world. It's not the reality. So Vedanta says, this universe, this world in which we are living, in which we interact with our fellow human beings, this body, this mind, this intellect, all these things are real, but relatively real, in the sense they come sometime in the past, they come into existence sometime in the past, they live for some time, maybe an insect may live for a few minutes, few seconds, this cosmos may live for maybe millions of years, but they're still there within time. An insect, as well as this cosmos, the Milky Way, the constellational stars, they're all relative in the sense they come into existence sometime in the past, maybe a few seconds back, maybe several millions of years back, and then exist for some millions of years, or maybe a few seconds, and then change. In the sense that the change is transition. Everything is transition in Vedanta. In fact, birth is a transition from a state of non-existence to a state of existence, birth. From a state of existence to non-existence, that is death. The effect going back to the cause is dissolution. The cause becoming the effect is birth, or beginning, creation, and the effect remaining in the state of effect is called existence. So everything in this world is relative. So nitya anitya vastu viveka, a discerning mind with which you understand what is the real and what is the relatively real or the unreal. The second qualification is you must have a strong mind, the courage to say no to those things which are not absolutely real and hold to what is the real, what is the absolute reality. The third qualification, you must have sense of control of the senses, mind, concentration, and so on, inner peace, tranquility, which come out of inner control and concentration. And the fourth qualification is a strong desire to come out of this trap, through non-attachment. Means a sincere desire for liberation. So mumukshutvam, a desire to be liberated. First, nitya anitya vastu vekaha. A strong sense of a discerning mind, rather, that will enable you to focus on the real and look upon the relative as the relative, and the ability to look upon the relative as not the absolute. That's what very often happens. You know why we get by attached? For a split second, though we may have read Vedanta, for a minute, for a split second, suddenly we look upon the relative of the absolute. Then we lose sight of the absolute. That's why people get attached. Really, attachment means a very miserable state of slavish obsession. You feel you're attached because one reason you are attached. Second reason, you want to come out of attachment. Otherwise, you won't discuss about attachment. You won't discuss about bondage unless you have some idea of liberation. Otherwise, you won't think of bondage. You won't feel bondage. The fact that you feel that there is such a thing as attachment, which is certainly a very unpleasant situation, that's because you want to come out of attachment, you want to be non-attached. So we feel there is such a thing as attachment. We feel there is a trap because we want to come out of the trap. If we are happy with the trap, we won't feel we are in a trap. Permanent residents of hell are in a very happy situation. There is no problem. Madhvacharya's one siddhanta is the Nitya Naraga Siddhanta. Those who have the permanent identity or ID, this is the residence of hell. For them there is no problem. So the third qualification is Samadhi Sukha Sampatti, as I said, sense control, the ability to restrain senses and mind, and fourth one, Mumukshutva. Now I will come to the Vedantic interpretation of the real. That for that again we have to take up an old analogy which you find in the ancient books of Buddhists, for example, in the Madhyamika Karika Nagarjuna, which is the Bible of the school of emptiness, the doctrine of emptiness, Sunyavada, and also in the Kumarila Bhatta's works on Mimamsa, Sloka Vartika, Tantra Vartika, and most prominently in the works of Shankaracharya in his commentaries on the Prasthanatraya. There, he analyzes the concept of reality from a very interesting angle. So you have to think of a vertical line. At the lowest level, there is the thing, or there are those things which are totally unreal, in the sense you cannot even intellectually conceive of. The total unreality cannot even be intellectualized. Can you ever think of something which has no possibility at all to exist? If suppose you say you imagine you are flying in the sky in dream, and you face it totally unreal, it's not totally unreal. What happens is the idea of flying, that memory is registered in the mind, and a desire to fly, and the fact that there are people who fly, or you have heard or you have read about people flying. So all these ideas come together, and they come together to form the wrong notion that you are flying in the sky. That's what is called dream. Mean mental projection. But what is absolutely unreal, which cannot even be intellectually conceived, we don't think about them. There is a statement in the Vedantic text. Aprasattasya prastavaha aprasaktasya ko nishethaka prasaktasya ka prastavaha prasaktasya ko nishethaka. What is obvious you can never deny it, and you don't normally affirm it. Do you ever make a statement, my name is this? Or do you make a statement, now this is daytime? You don't make a statement unless you want to be certified by psychiatrists. And we don't deny what is obvious. We don't deny what is obvious. We never take the trouble to deny what is totally unreal, what cannot be even intellectually conceived. And we don't deny what is obvious. So what we try to deny is only the relative. So all our speculations are on the relative, which are subject to change. Now Vedanta says this relative entity is called Vyavaharika Satta, which means this world, this chair, all these things which exist for some time and change. You are perfectly right that there is a chair in front of you. But you're totally wrong if you're going to tell me that this chair will exist for trillions of years. It's not going to happen. So it is only relative, because it's part of Nitya, the relative world. It belongs to time, space and causation. So the highest reality is Paramarthika Satta, which never comes into existence because there was no time when it did not exist. And therefore it's not going to vanish because there will be no time when it will not exist. So it is the ever-existing, the eternal. That is Atman, the Brahman, according to Vedanta. Everything else that we objectify, that we verbalize, that we define, that we describe, all belong to the relative plane. Then there are certain things that exist as ideas, which may not be real in front of you. For example, if you mistake a rope in semi-darkness, and if you interpret that rope as snake, if you mistake that rope for a snake, it is not absolute unreality, because there is a snake in the forest or a zoo which you are seeing, and you impose its form, its shape, its color on this object that you see in front of you, which is only a piece of rope, and because there is not enough light, you mistake that rope for the snake which you saw in the forest, which you kept in your memory. And from that memory, the image comes to the surface, and you put it, you impose it on the rope. So it is not total unreality, because snake exists in the zoo or in the forest. But then there is a total unreal, a totally unreal thing, which cannot even be indirectly considered. Examples are the Sanskrit text gives some classic examples. Children looking at the sky, maybe when there is a rainbow, they think there is a big city in the sky. There are shops, buildings, streets, small babies. Maybe in those days, they used to may have such illusions. So these examples are taken from ancient books. Now coming to attachment and detachment. What happens, as I said earlier, every problem of attachment is rooted in one cause. We interpret the relative as the absolute. We interpret the relatively real as the absolutely real. And the moment we keep the idea in mind of what is the absolute reality and the fact that everything else is only relatively real, then we will be able to keep the mind away from these problems. And that will help you, even intellectually, if you read these books, that will help you to reduce tension, conflicts, and of course, unnecessary competitions and rivalry. All the problems are due to our interpretation of things that exist for a short time as things that exist for all time. So we think money can bring us everything. Intellectually we may know, but when we enter the field of competition, we forget that for a split second and we get trapped. So there are two types of practicing non-attachment. One, even when you are working in this world, when you are working in your office, when you are working for the rival company, when you are working as competitors, even in a sports item, you have to come out the best, the first. Even then, if you are really speaking a Siddha Prajna, we are going to discuss that point, as the archetype of the philosophy or psychology of non-attachment. In the Gita, there's a long description in 18 verses, from 55th to 72nd verse of the second chapter. Towards the end, there's a graphic description of the character of a person or the characteristics of a person who is perpetually practicing non-attachment even in the midst of all activities. That is the highest stage. But there is another kind of non-attachment that any of us can try to practice. We may be working very hard, thinking that all these things are wonderful, and we go out of our way to struggle to achieve things. But then, at that time, we may forget the fact that all these things for which we work are only relative area. And we may not practice Vedanta at that time. But after some time, when you return home, when this competition, this rivalry create depression, cause loss of sleep, anxiety neurosis, at that time, if we read this Vedantic text, these ideas, and if you can remember that these things for which I'm struggling, which I may need them, but they are not eternal things. They are things that exist for some time. If not now, they have to vanish. Including our health, wealth, everything. Vedanta says everything. This body, ma, everything in this world is only a matter of time that before they vanish. This idea, if you can keep in mind, then many of the problems of conflict, stress, and anxiety neurosis can be reduced. This is a stage for the beginners. And as we gradually evolve, can constantly practice, maybe not at the time of being engaged in work, when we are busily engaged in work, but at least afterwards, when we lose sleep, or when we begin to play a foul game to attain our goal, we may perhaps put you in the prison in later years. When such temptations, which are normally related to attachment, then we can tell our own mind these things are not going to last for long. When unnecessary conflicts and competitions, rivalries, stress, anxieties, when all these depression, all these problems emerge, a constant reminder of the unreality or the relativity of all these things that will help us to link ourselves to the Absolute. Because unless we have an idea of the Absolute, and unless we are able to link our mind to the Absolute, by constantly reminding ourselves that all these things are only relative, that God is only absolute reality, or Brahman, or spiritual values. If you don't believe in God, you can say some universal spiritual values are the only absolute reality. And if we can constantly link our mind, keep our mind linked to that idea, then we'll be able to look upon the relative as the relative. If we don't do that, if we don't link our mind to the highest, to the absolute spiritual value, then the problem is we may imagine, we may interpret the relative, ephemeral, perishable things of a few years and days as permanent, eternal things. And we may fight, quarrel, and lose our sleep, suffer from depression, anxiety, neurosis, and other problems. So that's the solution given in the Gita. In fact, in the 12th chapter, Bhakti Yoga, in the context of Bhakti, evolution of Bhakti, Lord Krishna makes this point very clear. If you can always think of the highest, then do your work. Be ambitious, be enthusiastic, but then after it is done, for a moment you remember, mentally you think all these things belong to God. So, sarva karma phalatyagam prahustyagam vichakshana, you find. There are four levels of evolution. In the 12th chapter, from 8th to 11th verse, Lord Krishna gives a picture of the four levels of spiritual growth in devotional philosophy in a descending order. Mai eva mana athatsva mai buddhin niveshaya nivasishvesi mai eva adha utham nasamsaya अथ चित्तं समाधातुं न शक्नोषि मयि स्थिरम् अभ्यासयोगेन ततो माम् इच्छातुं धनञ्जय अभ्यासेऽपि असमर्थोऽसि मत्कर्म परमो भव मदर्थमपि कर्माणि कुर्वन् सिद्धिमवाप्स्यसि
अतः एतदपि अशक्तोऽसि कर्तुमद्योगमाश्रितः सर्वकर्म फलत्यागं तद् प्रागुस्त्यागं
विचक्षण प्राक्टिस् एनि आफ् दीस् थिङ्ग्स् अतः एतदपि अशक्तोऽसि कर्तुमद्योगमाश्रितः सर्वकर्मफलत्यागं मीन्स् इफ् यु केनाट् आल्वेस् थिङ्क् आफ् द एब्सल्यूट् इफ् यु केनाट् रिमेम्बर् the relativity of this world and always keep your mind linked to the absolute when you are engaged in work, then do your work. After doing your work, you can go home, read this book and remind ourselves, well, all these things are, I worked hard in the office, in the company, in the university, in the stock exchange, whatever. But then I have done my best, I worked hard, but then they should not cause me lose my sleep because those things are not going to last for long. Because we need something higher than things of this world of time, space and causation. So this is one way of evolving from attachment to non-attachment. And this is something which everyone can practice. In the midst of activities, you can do. In the Siddha Prakilakshana, you find it is the picture of a man of the highest spiritual achievement. But then elsewhere in the Gita, in the second chapter, you find Lord Krishna makes this point very clear. Yogastha kuru karmani sangam tikva dhananjaya siddhya siddhyo samabhutva samatam yogojya. It's not very, very easy, of course. Do your work. Being fully established in yoga, which means non-attachment. And then you should think beyond success and failure. Be even-minded in success and failure, which again is not meant for the very beginner, for those who are still at the early stage of spiritual evolution. But the method that I explained earlier, it could be practiced by any beginner. Do everything with great enthusiasm. You may call it great attachment, efficiency, planning. But then later on, when it pricks you, when your mind constantly dwell on the possibility or impossibility of good or bad results, success or failure, when you become anxious, when we lose sleep, at that time we can remind our mind, when all these things I may succeed or fail, whatever may be, then, but it is not going to last long. But normally, this is a kind of very, very effective method, because while doing work, you are able to do it with great enthusiasm, efficiency. After work, you are mentally able to kind of, you get a feeling of relaxation. A heavy burden is off your shoulders. When mentally we offer everything to God, if you are a devotee, it's easy. If you are not a devotee, if you are an intellectual analyst, if you follow the path of Jnana Yoga, then it is obvious to any well-educated person in this world that these things are not going to last. You need not be a philosopher to understand that money is not going to last for long. At least money, after all, is only a few digits that you see the computer screen. So you are not going to eat millions and millions of dollar notes. So it's only a figure which may change for the good or bad. But so we can work hard with concentration. At the same time, somewhere in a corner of our mind, remember that these things are not going to last long. This is one method of keeping our mind free. Now, of course, there are so many other things in Vedanta, but before going to that, I want to give you a picture of a spiritually enlightened person who is fully established in this state of non-attachment. In the second chapter, Arjuna asks one very interesting question to Lord Krishna. He is not discussing a philosophical problem directly, But indirectly, it's asking a very simple question. How do we understand when we find a spiritually enlightened person? You know, if somebody is sitting quiet in a hermitage or doing anything, there is no way to know whether he is actually an enlightened person. You have to see him in action, then only you understand whether he is able to practice spiritual enlightenment in the course of day-to-day life activities. You see, if a dog has no teeth, and if it doesn't bite, you know, you have to give him teeth first, then find out whether he bites or not. So, the spiritually enlightened person shows his spiritual characteristics in the midst of activities right in this world. That's why we do not have a single great spiritual teacher in the world who was lazy, inactive, or who was insensitive. All great teachers the world has seen were always active. Active not in the sense the physically active, but then they were always active, either spiritually, physically, or mentally. Now here, one question is put to Arjuna. Sthitapragnasya ka bhasa samadhisthasya keshava sthitaji kim prabhasheda kim asida vrajeda kim. This is a question. So Arjuna is putting one very simple question to Lord Krishna. What is the description of a person who has attained steady wisdom, who is practicing non-attachment, and who is well established in introspection, contemplation? How does he behave? How does he talk? And how does he go about doing his duties and responsibilities? How does he walk? How does he sit? All these questions are put. Practically, how does he interact with his fellow beings in this world? How do we recognize whether that person is spiritually enlightened or not? So there's a long description from 55th verse to 72nd verse, 18 verses, a very graphic description of a spiritually enlightened person. But one imagery I can present before you of these 18 verses. Well, that's an imagery of an ocean. Hundreds of rivers are flowing to this ocean, emptying their waters in the ocean. The ocean doesn't get perturbed or disturbed. The ocean remains steady, calm and quiet. The ocean doesn't go and invite the rivers to come to empty their waters. The ocean doesn't know when they flow the ocean. Say, it neither seeks nor avoids. So it remains in a state of steady wisdom. Like that, if we can keep our mind always in a state of steadiness, tranquility, and serenity, in the midst of activities, that is the state of a spiritually enlightened person who is practicing non-attachment. Non-attachment is the topic of discussion in the early verses. Apuryamanam acharapradishtam samutramapa pravishandhi yadud tadud kamayam pravishandhi sarve sa shantim apnodi na kamakami. Now, if you can remain like this ocean, you will be able to be active all the time and you will be able to enjoy peace with it. The problem is, action is totally unavoidable. Lord Krishna makes a grand statement. Nahi kasi kshanam abhi jadu tishthati akarma krita. Kari dekhi avashak karma sarva pragati jayihi gunaihi. You can never remain physically and mentally and spiritually inactive, even for one split second. Even if you take a decision to be inactive, suppose you sit in an easy chair, our mind will be speculating. Physically we may be inactive, but mentally we may be hyperactive. Now if you try to practice introspection through the process of physical inactivity, there is a great danger. Karmendriyani samyamya ya astaya manasasmaran indriyartha nimodhatma mithyacharaka sauchyate. Lord Krishna makes a very strong statement. These are fundamental principles in practical Vedanta. He says, if a person cannot really remain inactive mentally and physically all the time, but if a person really tries to do that, he'll end up being a hypocrite. How? Physically, he may remain in a state of inaction. So, but then his mind is not steady. So, his mind will be always speculating on possible achievements, desires that could be, that he could be full, that could be fulfilled, great things he could achieve, and so on. At the same time, he's sitting there without doing anything. He would like to be seen as a great karma yogi. Frequently, you know, karma yogi, it is sometimes very badly interpreted as inaction. It was that one of Swami Vivekananda's main problem was to re-educate Indians on the very concept of karma yoga. In fact, he took great pains to teach, his lecture you find many, many statements. You'll be surprised. Swamiji sometimes tells people you should have modern education, science, technology, you should have prosperity, you should be able to synthesize the best fruits of India's spiritual heritage with the best fruits of Occidental Greco-Roman tradition, efficiency, work ethic, organization, discipline, and so on. The reason was, Swamiji says, you have forgotten Lord Krishna's true Vedantic message of karma yoga. Instead, what they did, by remaining inactive, people started trying to be spiritual. Lord Krishna says, a person who tries to be physically inactive and then pretends to be spiritually advanced just because of his physical inactivity alone is a hypocrite. Yasti indriyani manasa nirmi arabhade arjuna karmendriye karma yogam asaktasya visishyate. First, he draws the picture of a hypocrite. That's why in the Gita you find four stages of evolution of karmaity. At lowest level, total inaction, which is to be spurned, avoided, rejected by everyone. Lethargy, inaction, inactivity, laziness, and then interpreting all this as signs of spirituality. Second stage of evolution is action with desire, action with a strong motive, with total attachment, maybe in a very worldly sense. But that's better than remaining totally inactive, out of laziness, ignorance, and lethargy. That is tamoguna, the other is rajoguna, action with desire. The third stage is the same action that you do with desire, you should be able to do without desire. That is karma yoga, through non-attachment to the results. The fourth stage is karma nishtha, karma yoga nishtha, being established in this action, in this philosophy of action, without any desire, without any motive, but without total dedication. That means a spiritually enlightened person naturally becomes a karma yogi. Whatever he does naturally becomes a classic model of karma yoga, action without any attachment. These are four levels. So now, the beginning, Lord Krishna gives a very strong message. Nekika sikshanamabhi jadu dishtha dhyakarmakrita. You cannot remain inactive for one split second. If you try to do that, you'll be a hypocrite. Mithyachara sauchade. Then he gives a picture of the Raya karma yogi. Yastu indriyani manasa niyamya arabhade arjuna karmendriya karma yogam asaktasya visishyate. So a real karma yogi is the one who works with his mind, his intellect, his senses of perception, senses of action, but mind is totally non-attached. Mind is not obsessed. Very often, in the psychology of attachment, the problem is very simple. We do things and we want to achieve the results. But within the mind, there's a lurking desire to remain non-attached because we have read about it in books. And we know that if we can remain non-attached, we'll be much better. Our big, huge burden will be off our shoulders. We'll feel a great relaxation. We know that we have read about it. We may have listened to these things. But when we try, somehow the mind cannot be taken off, away from this link to the result, attachment. But we recognize this slavery as slavery. We recognize this trap as a real trap, which is possible only if you want to come out of the trap, if you want to come out of this slavery. So at that stage, one method is this, to constantly remember, well, we must be active, but even while being active, we must be able to link our mind to a higher ideal. That linking to the higher ideal helps us to get rid of this obsession. Obsession is what is actually called attachment. See, in modern, highly industrialized societies, family life, family relationship is a big problem. So sometimes you have to speak about the sanctity of family relationship. The need to be attached in a very positive sense. Children should remain attached. They should not dump their parents nor these homes. They should look after them. Then parents should not dump their children in daycare, home, what do you call it? Maybe. Daycare, what? Maybe. Where somebody, a paid servant, will look after them. The children grow up without any respect or failing obligation to their parents. And parents also practically have nothing to do with children. So in the 18th year, the parents will require the children to get away from their homes, so and they should pay rent for every month if they want to continue. Now, in such a society, to talk about non-attachment or detachment is really broad. We have to talk about the sanctity, the need, the importance, the spiritual significance of the sanctity of family relationship. That should be stressed. Now, what about this subject of non-attachment in this context? What is meant by Lord Krishna? That's exactly what he means. This attachment should not become an obsessive, slavish obsession. It should not become a slavish obsession. It should not be like a big granite piece that is tied around your neck that you cannot move. That should not happen. So our whole perspective, attitude should be slightly refined or modified. That's what exactly Lord Krishna says. In fact, he himself was a great exponent of the sanctity, the spiritual relevance of family relationship. He himself was a great exponent of all the great values that are so very important in the institution of family life. What he means is, sometimes this slavish obsession becomes a burden and it may make us do undesirable things. Especially when this slavish obsession is linked to wealth, physical pleasures, and also competition, unhealthy cutthroat competition that turn us into monsters and demons. In such a situation, this philosophy of a spiritual philosophy of non-attachment, which is built on the foundation of linking our mind directly to higher spiritual ideas, and not cutting the links that bind us to our near and dear ones. It is not a kind of cold, inhuman way of detaching ourselves from our near and dear ones. No. But the other way is, it is actually giving a spiritual dimension to human relationship. With non-attachment as an ideal, our human relationships, even family relationships, gets a spiritual orientation. That's what exactly Lord Krishna is speaking about here. Yes, to indriyani manasa niyamya arabhadyachana. So, mentally, we must link to a higher spiritual ideal, and then we must do our work in this world. Whatever may be our role. That's what Lord Krishna is speaking about. How is this possible? This could be achieved by practicing one idea. Of course, it is a high spiritual idea. Prajahadi yada kaman sarvan partha manukada atmanne vatmanatushtara siddha prajnistadochi. Of course, this is a very high state. We can always see when all the desires of the heart have been abandoned, when we feel a kind of inner satisfaction within ourselves. So the stress should be on the other, this later part of the statement. Means, when we ourselves can enjoy a kind of inner peace and fulfillment and tranquility by realizing that we are something other than the physical body, physical senses, and we are something other than this physical entity that enjoys the sensory pleasures. We are really the Atman, a higher spiritual ideal. In that case, you know what happens? We will be able to remain in a state of inner contentment, in a state of inner blissfulness. And that blissfulness will help us to remain non-attached. So the third one is there, in 57th verse. Ye sarvatra anabhisneha tattat prapya subha asubham na abhinandati na dveshti tasya prajna pratishthita. Now, if you read it, you may sometimes, you may lose the real implication, literal translation. Yes, sarvatra anabhisneha tattat prapya subha asubha. I mean, you should not have any affection, self-centered, slavish, selfish affection. That's the meaning. Abhisneha here means selfish affection, obsessive attachment towards worldly things. That later on create problems. So that's why anabhisneha means without this slavish obsession. The difference between a spiritually enlightened person and his opposite in terms of love and affection and human relationship is simple. A spiritually enlightened person has no hatred for anyone. He accommodates all. He has love and affection, good feelings, good wishes for all. But his opposite, who may be attached to his or her children or relatives or maybe friends to such an extent that he hates all others. So that's the main difference. A spiritually enlightened person, Sri Ramakrishna puts in a very simple language, you know, Maya and Daya in one context. Daya means compassion. That's what is meant. That's the affection of a spiritually enlightened person. It is universal. In normal situations, you know, when we are attached to somebody, very often it also can take the form of hatred towards somebody else. It is like two sides of the same coin. Obsessive, selfish attachment to anything is only one side of the coin. There should be another side. That side will be great costly to us. Of course, there are exceptions. But here we are talking about the obsessive, slavish attachment. And it may sometimes creates hostile feelings, animosity, negative relationship with others. On the other hand, a spiritually enlightened person may love, may have affection for his or her relations, children, but it will be totally unmixed with its negative. Means it will be positive love and affection for all, including his own or her own children. It will not take the form of hostility towards others. In the Gita, there is a statement, Sukham atyantikam yatat buddhi grahi mati indriya. The same aspect. What is joy? Normally, joy or happiness in the worldly sense is only the absence of unhappiness. In the worldly sense, joy is only the absence of its opposite. Sukham is not really sukham. It is not real joy. It is only apparently an absence of misery. But this relative joy may one day vanish, because anything that produces relative joy is short-lived. The coin has another side, its opposite. So every experience of pain in the worldly sense will one day give place to misery. Sorry, pain will give place to joy. So every worldly experience of joy will one day give place to misery. Because the object that brings this joy will cease to exist, it will vanish. Then this joy itself becomes misery or unhappiness. Similarly, when we are attached, slavishly, obsessed with something, that may give us a kind of satisfaction for the time being. But any such slavish obsession or attachment is bound to change tomorrow. Then it becomes misery. On the other hand, if we can love our own people with an even mind, and if that love is part of love for the whole humanity, universal love, then that love will be positive love. It's like a coin with only one side, without its other side. That's why sukham atyantikam yata. The real joy is the joy that goes beyond the five senses of perception, and also beyond mind. That joy, the real joy, that is a joy that comes out of spiritual fulfillment. It is not the absence of misery, it is a real joy. All experiences of joy in the relative world, other than the joy that comes out of spiritual fulfillment, is only the absence of misery. And that joy will one day become misery when the object which brought that joy vanishes. And it is bound to vanish. Everything in this world is bound to change. Therefore, Lord Krishna says, Yes, sarvatra anabhisneha tatta prapya subhasubha. So, we may work hard for the good, for success, but if we do not always succeed, then we will not become miserable if we can work for success with an even mind. If we work for success with an obsessed, slavish, attached mind, then failure could be a great disaster. It can create a lot of anxiety. So, that's a technique of practicing practical Vedanta, which you find in the descriptions of the practice. So we'll continue the discussion tomorrow, and we'll have interaction now. In the course of interaction, if you want more explanation of this, it'd be better. Thank you.
There are four qualifications: hold on to the absolute reality, control the mind and the senses, and strong desire to come out of this trap through non-attachment, which is the last stage. I think I missed one.
No, I will. First one is a sense of discrimination between the real and unreal. The second one is a feeling of renunciation of the unreal, which is actually important to remain non-attached. When our mind is linked to the unreal, we interpret the unreal as the real. And when the unreal vanishes, as is bound to vanish, then it brings problems. So the unreal should be interpreted as the unreal. I mean the relative, in the sense. So that's why first qualification is, we must know what is real. And then we must hold fast to the real. Second, we must give up. That is, ikhamutra phala bhoga vidara, means we must give up all momentary objects that may give us momentary joy, satisfaction, which one day may become a source of misery. The third one is sense control, mind control, I mean samadhi sukha sampatti, and practice of contemplation, concentration, so on. The fourth one is, and that's very important, a strong desire for liberation, which comes out of our conviction, our understanding of the relative as the relative. We must be able to understand that trap is a trap, attachment is a problem, then only we will work for non-attachment. That is implication. Yes. If you have no question, I can continue the discussion because there are many more important, and we have just one day. So I can continue the discussion if you have no questions.
Yes.
Continue. Oh, very good. Now, in the next verse, in the 58th verse, Lord Krishna says, one must develop the faculty to withdraw one's senses from their objects. So there's a illustration given, like a tortoise that's able to withdraw its limbs for its own protection. Yada sankhara dechayam hormongani vasarvasaka indriyani indriyarthebhya tasya prajna pratishthita. Now how do we develop this skill? It is possible only when in the midst of our daily engagement and activities, we keep our mind linked to the high spiritual ideal. So, there should be a bridge that connects our daily activities, so-called secular activities, and spiritual practice. If we divide our life and activities into two compartments and call one as spiritual, the other secular, then we won't, and if they remain apart all the time, separate, then we won't be able to practice non-attachment. Attachment has to be practiced in the context of daily duties and responsibilities and activities. That's the place where attachment is needed. So how do we become non-attached? So, non-attachment is possible only by linking the mind to a higher ideal. When the mind is linked to a higher ideal, then problems that normally occur in our life will not be big dilemmas. Frequently, we interpret a small problem as a very big problem because we believe that problem will remain there forever. That's what really happens. We lose sleep. We lose our sleep, we become too anxious because we think the problem or the difficulty that is causing so much of anxiety is going to stay there forever. The moment we understand that things are bound to change in this world and the world itself is subject to change, then of this, the anxiety could be reduced. But this is possible only by linking the mind to a higher idea. So, one should keep always in mind that this world, obligations, duties, all these things are bound to change. They are only relative. What Shankaracharya called vyavaharika satta means things which are part of our everyday experience. Real only in the context of everyday experience. Vyavahara means everyday interaction with the rest of the world. It is there, but it is bound to change. In Vedanta, there is only one reality that is eternal. Anything that is subject to change can never be eternal. That is why whatever there is which is subject to change is real only in the context of the particular time, the particular space, and also the cause from which that event came, that is causation. It's a relativity. So in the midst of activities, the mind should be linked to a higher ideal. Then automatically, we'll be able to withdraw mentally from all these problems. Mind should be linked to a higher ideal. That's why Sri Ramakrishna puts in the language of a person who is trying to cross the line. Now this boat is the line, our life. And we are trying to cross the river in a ferry. water should not be within the boat. The boat should be on the surface of water. So how to keep the boat always on the surface of water without water entering the boat? In real life, mind should be linked to the higher idea. And then problems of relative world will not become big dilemmas. There will be problems, but it will not be such a huge dilemma as to cause loss of sleep, too much of anxiety. So mind automatically withdraws from all this and gets linked to a higher idea. The same idea you find, Vishaya vinivartante nirahārasya dehinaha vasavarjam rasopyasya parandushtva nivartate. The absolute non-attachment is possible only when we reach the highest spiritual reality. Here, in the next two verses, there are some strong warnings even here. Yadato hebi gaundeya purushasya vivaschidaha indriyani pramathini harandi prasabham manaha tani sarvani samyamya yukta asidamatparaha vasehi yasindriyani tasya pratnyapadishtita. The description of steady wisdom. Here the Lord Krishna says, even to those who work very hard, for them also sometimes there are hidden traps and dangers and risks. Mind may suddenly get distracted and dissipated. So that's why constant awareness is necessary. So in the midst of all activities, mind should be fed with positive spiritual food. It could be through reading, discussion, so on. The mind is dragged into all kinds of external objects. The five senses of perception, the sense of touch, sense of sight, sense of taste, sense of smell, and sense of everything. All these together are dragging the mind towards different external objects. So mind gets trapped. And in that case, you know what happens? Sometimes we lose our path. So the only way is we should give a spiritual orientation to the mind. We cannot really give a spiritual orientation to the mind without giving a spiritual orientation to the senses of perception. Mind is more subtle. We can have some option on what we are going to see. We have some choice as to what we are going to hear. We have some choice as to what we are going to taste, as to what we are going to touch, as to what we are going to smell. But we may not have much option as to what thought is going to emerge in your mind next second. That's one problem. We cannot manage our mind the way we manage a machine. Mind is the most difficult thing to control. It's almost impossible to control. So in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra you find all the yoga citta vritti nirodha. Actually it only means sublimation or refinement of mind. How do we do that? By giving a spiritual orientation to our five senses. Because mind is colored, mind is formed, mind is constituted by tendencies, impressions and samskaras brought into it by the five senses of perception. When we see an object, that visual object remains the mind. So after 10 years again, you may relive seeing that object. When we hear a word, after years, we may again re-experience hearing that word. That's why we are able to learn music. You hear once, and the next day you repeat. But sound waves are not again falling to eardrums. What happens? Mentally, we re-experience hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting, so on. So what happens? It is these five senses which are constantly feeding the mind. Mind gets its food only from the five senses. That is Shankaracharya and Ramanuja, they interpret. Food is not only what you eat. Food is also what the five senses bring to your mind. And what we eat, what we think, determine how our mind is going to function. So the only way to refine, to modify, to purify our mind is by giving a spiritual orientation to the functions of the five senses of perception. And eventually, five senses of action also. We can never hear something without that word or that speech, that sound creating some impact in our mind. We can never see an object without that vision, that visual process creating, leaving some mark, some influence, some impact on the mind. So mind is nothing but the totality of what the five senses of perception bring. Eventually, the five senses of action also have some role. So Lord Krishna says, mind should be given a spiritual orientation, and that is possible only by giving a spiritual orientation to the functions of the five senses of perception. Eyes, ears, sense of touch, sense of smell, sense of taste, and so on. And in here's a demonstration. Dhyayato vishayan pumsaha, sangasteshu vajayade, sangha sanjayade kamaha, kama krodho vijayade, krodhar bhavadi sammoha, sammoha smudhi vibhramam, smudhi bhramsar buddhinasu, buddhinasa pranasiti. The fall of human mind, how mentally we degrade ourselves, here's a graphic description. First he says, if our mind dwells for a long time on sense objects, what happens, you know? Mind gets attached to them. Frequently, it happens the other way also. Mind has a tendency to get attached to what is available, what in the surroundings. Both ways it happens, the commentators will say. Mind gets attached, focused on certain external objects. But mind can only be attached to what is available around us. So sometimes one topic for discussion in International Gita Conference, the role of media. Actually, media can present healthy objects for concentration. Media can influence human culture, human civilization. If media always present unhealthy objects for mind to concentrate on, then what happens, you know, mind naturally gets focused, concentrated on external object, which may be unhealthy eventually. Then what happens, mind gets attached to that. Once the mind is focused, attached to something, then it will chase it. It will go upright. There is strong desire to achieve, to enjoy that. And all desires cannot be fulfilled. When all desires are not fulfilled, it leads to depression, anger, and then delusions. And practically, it leads to degeneration of culture, of mind. So, Lord Krishna says, the only way out is to give a spiritual orientation to all the five senses of perception. We cannot keep our eyes closed. We cannot keep our ears non-functional. But whatever we hear, whatever we see, may not always be spiritually helpful. But we can make some effort to see and hear things which may be helpful in spiritual life, along with seeing and hearing things which may not be helpful. So, we can also hear and see things which could be helpful. Along with those things which may not be helpful, we can also see and experience things which could be helpful. Because mind is a bundle, that's why Danda says, good tendencies and bad tendencies. Every action produces a vritti, an impression, a modification. It becomes a samskara, a strong motive, tendency to act. Samskara becomes a vasana, a strong inclination, aptitude. It can again make you to decide to do things in a certain way, sankalpa, and you may do certain things, again the cycle continues. So Lord Krishna says, spiritual life begins with a deliberate conscious effort to give a spiritual orientation to the five senses of perception, which may eventually influence the mind. And once the mind is refined, we can get ourselves linked to a higher spiritual idea. which enables us to remain non-attached towards things which are undesired. That's the idea. I think now we have interaction. Maybe 20 minutes.
So, we see both the relation between soul and mind.
Mind is only a function of vrittis, vasanas, tendencies. Mind is not an entity. When the Atman fully reflects on the mind, we become spiritually enlightened. Very often the Atman doesn't fully reflect on the mind. When the mind is clouded, stained, when it is not clean. And how to clean the mind? By giving a spiritual orientation to mind. Which again is possible by giving a spiritual orientation to the five senses, which bring impressions, tendencies, modifications of mind. And mind slowly becomes clean. When mind becomes clean, the Atman reflects on mind the greater effulgence. So, one sign is we feel serenity, calmness, inner fulfillment. That's the idea. So, mind is only a function, it's not the name of a function. Even William James' stream consciousness, it's just a flow of tendencies and impressions. It is not an entity in Vedanta. When mind is turned inward towards Atman, there is no mind. Mind is mind only so long as it is attached to different objects with the help of the five senses of perception. Mind and eyes go together and see an object. Mind and ears go together and hear a voice, a noise. Mind and sense of touch go together and we touch this book. Mind and sense of smell go together and you feel the aroma of an incense stick. Like that. Mind and the sense of taste go together and we experience food. The taste of food. So all these color the mind. So if we can always focus on the higher spiritual ideal, then these vagaries, changing impressions will not leave a permanent mark on the mind. Mind will remain clean. And one sign that Atman is reflecting on the mind with great effulgence is we feel a kind of inner fulfillment, inner calmness, because that's the very essence of spirituality. Spirituality cannot be defined. But spiritual growth can be felt, and in Vedanta and Yoga it's called Chitta Prasada. So here Chitta Prasada means inner tranquility, inner fulfillment, which you can never experience through any other means. Any kind of worldly achievements cannot give us this feeling of inner fulfillment. Because when you get it, you get the feeling there is nothing higher to be sought, to be attained. Any other worldly objects, if you get, you have a desire for more of it. But once we get this Chitta Prasada, inner fulfillment, inner blissfulness, kind of, you find inner, what is your inner completeness, you feel. That's a sign of Atman reflecting the mind with greater and higher effulgence. That's the idea.
So when we leave our body, this soul will leave our bodies, this gross body, then that same mind will go with the soul, or how it will?
Actually these tendencies and impressions gathered in the mind will follow us as part of the Sukshma Sharira. So Sukshma Sharira has got 17 compartments according to one analysis. These 17 compartments, Mana and Buddhi, five senses of perception, five senses of action, and Pancha Mahabhudas. Okay. Now the question arises. If you read the book, any Vedantic book, it will tell you these 17 items include Pancha Jnanendriyani and Pancha Karmendriyani, which means five senses of action, five senses of perception. Our ears, sense of touch, sense of smell do not follow this body. So what's the interpretation? The impressions that you gathered with the help of this I and the mind will remain. The impressions that you gather with the ears and this mind will remain. The impressions that you gather, the mind, any of the five senses will remain in subtle form. It's called vasanas, vrittis, which again will be born again with the next body. That's why we sometimes are born with some strong inclinations and tendencies. You try to act the other way, you feel you are out of the way. Something wrong in it. So you feel a natural inclination to behave in a given way. There's a bigger definition, which is called Puryashtara, means 8 units. That's another, which is practically the same. So this Sukshma Sharira, it continues to exist. What is Sukshma Sharira? A subtle personality. What is our subtle personality? Not this body, but what we think, what impression we have, our natural attitudes, our natural inclinations, what we do when we are not under any compulsion. What are natural inclinations? They constitute our Sukshma Sharira, subtle body. And the gross body is only a vehicle, a tool through which it manifests, it functions.
Constantly this kind of pressure that comes where, you know, so you have to choose your major, you choose your focus, you choose your thesis, all these things. And there's often this feeling that you're picking your path, you're picking what you're going to do in this world, and a lot of anxiety comes with that, because maybe you're thinking, oh, this is, I want to choose the path that can do the most good, or something like that. And that kind of, that can cause a lot of anxiety and headache. I mean, I just want to hear your statement. You know, is the root cause of that always some sort of vanity, basically, some sort of ego, that, you know, a lack of humility, or, you know, can you describe about that kind of anxiety and how to see that in a better spiritual perspective?
If the students are professionals, they have to follow the demands and needs of them. Of the conditions and circumstances, your parents' suggestion, your teacher's suggestion, your friends' views, and all that. But then that you do to the best of your ability and your interest. But then keep the mind linked to a higher idea. I mean, you can try to be the best architect or scientist or mathematician in the world. Nothing wrong in it. But if you can always keep, but there is something higher than being the greatest mathematician of the world. There is something higher, much more sublime than being the best architect in the world. Because even the best or the cleverest or more efficient of them are not necessarily very happy. They don't feel the inner fulfillment. So there is something higher. The higher values this kind of inner spiritual evolution. Once we can keep that in mind, then these things will not create anxiety. Anxiety comes out of the wrong notion that this is the end. This is not only the goal, but as an end, the ultimate supreme thing to be achieved. But once you remember, once you link your mind to a higher value, a higher goal, then you may work sincerely for this, but vagaries or changes or success or failure at this level will not have a destabilizing, disastrous impact on your mind. You have to face challenges. And when you face challenges, there will be anxieties. There will be work. You cannot have everything as a bed of roses. But along with that, keep the mind to a higher idea. There is something higher to be achieved. It can be done by reading these books, through meditation, through spiritual contemplation. So,
sorry if I may. I guess the question was really about about compassion in some sense, because.
You feel your ego, vanity, compassion, and all that. Well, I tell you, suppose you want to be the best mathematician in the world. Nothing wrong. It's not ego. It's not ego. We often have a wrong notion. We'll be very humble, so I should not try to be the best. I should give the best place to somebody else. No. We should try to be the best. Still, we can be humble. That's a real humility. We should try to do our best, because even the best mathematician, if we are going to become, is an expression of the inner spiritual reality.
I'm still not being able to ask the question clearly enough.
Yes, the question is not very...
I'm just saying that, you know, at Stanford or something like that, it's oftentimes very puffed up. It's very like, okay, you have been chosen from all these applicants, and then now you're given this opportunity, and there's sort of this burden, this expectation that because you're given this opportunity to get this education, a secular education, that you would give back, as greatly as you can. And the anxiety comes because then people are trying to learn about, you know, okay, well, what do? You know, you're going to go be work in international development or be a researcher, whatever it is. That anxiety comes from the question of what is the greatest contribution that you should be able to give, based on what you've received in this privilege, right? This is the kind of narrative that is constantly put into, I think, in these universities. And that causes a lot of anxiety, a great deal of anxiety. And I'm just saying that, you know, how can we guard, is it basically when that anxiety comes, is it also based on a certain different kind of vanity, you know, a different kind of vanity or ego that we should guard against? And, you know, I just want to hear your explanation about that, because that's something that I think comes up a lot in schools.
Yes, sometimes they become very egoistic because they are the chosen few from many, so many applicants. But from a spiritual perspective, one should do his best to reach the goal. If you are a mathematician, you can try to be the best mathematician. But if you become the best mathematician, and also if you imbibe spiritual values, that's the greatest contribution you can make. And if your ego can be given a positive orientation, ego has a positive role to play, creative, constructive role to play. Ego can be a very creative and constructive force that helps us to go forward and to do great things. See, great philanthropists who made a lot of money, billions of dollars. Later they start foundations to help people fighting AIDS, Ebola, and things like that. Unless they have some ego, an ego that is given a positive orientation, creative orientation, they won't be able to take a decision to start the foundation and undertake these huge philanthropic activities. Don't you think that's a great thing to do? To give ego a positive, a creative, a constructive orientation. The ego of a Hitler and the ego of an Einstein. Einstein made this atomic bomb, he didn't mean that perhaps. He didn't mean to make something that is so destructive, of course. But there are people who are egoistic in a very destructive, negative sense. One can be egoistic in a very positive sense. That positive, spiritually oriented ego takes you beyond ego. Ego, you cannot just get rid of ego. Lord Krishna makes an interesting statement, very funny. Na buddhi vedam janayi rajnanam karma sankina. Means, one should not start his work, one should not try to practice karma yoga all of a sudden on a good morning. So when you take a decision, tomorrow onwards I shall be completely non-attached. It'll be a terrible problem. Because now you're working with a definite motive, definite plan for something good. And tomorrow onwards, if you are not fully equipped, if you are not properly instructed, and if you start practicing, well, I won't be attached to mathematics, to my results. I'll be in remedied. You'll be a terrible mathematician, you'll be a miserable failure. Which should not happen. So what you should do, you should first, to begin with, give a positive, creative, constructive orientation to ego. In fact, Sri Ramakrishna speaks about it. The importance of a creative ego. That's why, you know, even in spiritual life, we need a strong determination. Very much, very important. So, suppose you are a chosen student, you are chosen for a higher research program, and you are doing your best. And after becoming the best in that field, still if you can contribute something creative and constructive to the world, that's the best way you can be spiritual. So there you are giving a spiritual orientation to ego. That ego is nothing wrong in it. That ego slowly takes you beyond egoism.
So first, we have to get rid of the wrong ego, destructive ego, arrogance and so on. Then we should give a positive orientation to our ego. That orientation will take you beyond it. Look at Buddha. Buddha saw a dead body, a sick man, and also an aged person, and then an ascetic. So Buddha left his home. He was a man of strong determination. Was it not ego? His father must have felt the fellow is very egoistic. Because he left that day, he left his palace, he became a mendicant, he became a great teacher. Now, without a strong determination, and what you call spiritualized ego, ego with a positive orientation, you would not have got a Buddha. So also very many great men, they became great, later they became very humble also. So this is a gradual evolution. First, we begin with giving a creative, constructive, positive, spiritual orientation to our ego. That leads to purification of ego and purification of mind. Great men are born out of this creative, constructive orientation of the ego. So when you use the word ego, often it's got a very bad negative connotation, but it becomes just the opposite of it when it gets a spiritual orientation. That's the thing. Look at Gandhi. Gandhi was a very egoistic person because he had a strong faith in his ability. But it was a creative, constructive, spiritual ego. Christ had was a very egoistic person in that sense, because he was teaching and he believed what he taught will be good for the world. It was good for the world. So without a creative, constructive ego, you cannot even be spiritual. So this beginning, natural beginning of the spiritual education. So first we must give a creative, constructive orientation to ego. The ego becomes pure, refined, and becomes a great help to you and great blessing to the whole world. That's the thing. Then you will get rid of anxiety. Anxiety is linked to your anxiety. Well, what I'm going to do? Is it good for me, good for others? It comes for a very noble person, this feeling comes. And what I'm doing is going to be good for others. So, at this stage, if we give a positive spiritual orientation to your ego, it's going to be a great thing. You can get beyond ego, you can transcend ego, only by first giving a spiritual orientation to your ego. Creative, constructive orientation.
Sabji, another angle of this, I think, is talking about, the expectation is very tall.
That is true.
And, you know, they're always expecting, like what you're telling, it's very common in the schools. We are giving you this incredible opportunity, you have to perform. It is basically this, like this, perform or perish. If the performance is not there, which is regularly monitored, then you perish. So that's another source of anxiety, you know. In many of the students these days, they face this kind of anxiety.
That's true. So in the midst of all that, if they can link, of course, depends upon different levels of students, their perspectives and attitudes. Now, one way is to link out to a higher idea, which may not be possible. If you can't do that, give a spiritual orientation. You are going to be the best physicist ever, mathematician. Where you are going to contribute something to the good of humanity. That's a great, grand idea. Anything that helps you to make a constructive contribution to the world, to others, including yourself, without any negative, destructive element in it, that is high, that is noble. And that also gives you a feeling, well, I am doing something noble. You may have to face a lot of challenges, anxieties, but in the midst of it, the inner feeling, well, I'm doing something that is going to be good for others, good for me also. So that will take away at least 50% of the anxiety problem. So that's why what is meant by giving a creative, constructive, positive, spiritual orientation to ego.
one should never try to be, one should never try to get rid of ego. It's dangerous for students, dangerous for people working the world. Sri Ramakrishna never did that. So when Vivekananda is a ruthless dialectician, who was an agnostic, he asked good questions to Sri Ramakrishna. He never asked him to keep quiet. No. He encouraged him to ask questions. If somebody told you, don't ask questions, obey me, don't listen to him, and don't go again to learn to listen to him again. One sign of real teaching, genuine teaching is, it allows you to ask questions. So real inquiry with the real thirst for knowledge and enlightenment is like a straight line. It takes you beyond ignorance. It takes you the real wisdom. But again, the intellectual arrogance is like a cycle. You go on asking questions, you don't take very seriously what you are asking or what answer you are getting. That's like a wheel that goes on rotating. It never begins anywhere, it never ends anywhere. So real constructive creative ego will take you beyond itself, beyond ego. It really takes you to a state where you are totally free from ego. See, look at all these great Shankaracharya. He was less than 7 years old when he left his home. Today we are reading Gita, we are discussing Vedanta because he wrote the most marvelous books in the world, the most marvelous devotional poetry, founded temples, puja, everything is creation. Do you think he was a very humble man, I should not do anything? Because it made me egoistic, so I should not write commentaries on the Gita.
He used to get into debates, really.
Yeah, and he used to debate, he used to demolish the views of anarchists, nihilists, and all that. That is his joke. And everything he finished with 32 years. Now, Gandhi made a statement, you know. Gandhi, after India got independence in 1947, before he passed away in 1948, he said, what the great Shankaracharya achieved within his short lifespan of 32 years, the British Empire could not undo in 190 years. British Empire started in 1757, Battle of Plassey. And he left India in 1947, 190 years. And Shankara lived for 32 years. And he said, Gandhi said, what Shankara achieved within a short lifespan of 32 years, the British Empire could not undo in 190 years. Because these were all these things, the strong foundation they tried to do. So, do you think if you were thought very humble, then you would not have done anything? So, behind every great man, a great woman, great achievement, there is this spiritually enlightened ego, which is given a positive, creative, constructive orientation. That's a high goal. So, thank you. Now, I think it will remain here tomorrow. Then we'll continue the discussion. Please don't forget to ask tomorrow. Thank you. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Tat Sat. Sri Ramakrishna. Namaste.